proceed to the second case for argument today, the United States versus Scozan. Mr. Meyer. Mr. Meyer, what is the pronunciation of your client's last name?
Scozan. And I think the document was that his first name is John, where in reality it's Roman Scozan.
Roman. All right. Thank you.
The first issues I want to address as far as the defendant's appeal are jurisdictional related issues. The first one relates to count one, the conspiracy to possess items stolen from an interstate shipment and to further transport them in interstate commerce. I, as argued in the district court and have argued here, have submitted that interstate commerce is an element of the offense. From what the reading I take on the government's brief, they agree that it's an element of the offense. The burden of proof, of course, is beyond a reasonable doubt. The government doesn't contest that.
But wait a minute. This is a conspiracy case, right?
Yes,
so
it is.
So it's a conspiracy to steal this type of good. And whether the person needs to know or not that those goods are from interstate commerce is a different issue. They only need to know that the goods were stolen, normally. And under your theory, I suppose there could never be a sting operation of any kind here if the trailer had been empty and they had made an agreement to steal goods that had been moved in interstate commerce and they were getting ready to implement the next step of that agreement and walked across the street to the trailer. The fact that they had agreed and the fact that these were the goods they wanted to steal would not be enough in your view.
Under FIOLA and its progeny, and as the government argued for the first time on appeal, there is authority for the fact that in an uncompleted conspiracy, that is where the conspiratorial agreement has not been fulfilled, the government is allowed to prove the interstate commerce element by the mental state of the defendant or defendants. That is, did they believe they were receiving stolen goods? However, at trial, the government didn't rely on that theory. They proved that these cigarettes, or they attempted to prove, that they had moved in interstate commerce. That's what the grand jury indictment states. That's what the jury instructions at trial stated. That's how the government argued on the case.
They did allude to the other theory. I realize perhaps didn't make a big point of it, but there are some places in the record that they did. So I take it you agree then that it would be, had they only said, in your view, more of the right things, there wouldn't be a jurisdictional problem here.
No, I wouldn't even concede that point, Your Honor. And that is because if you read FIOLA, it states that the mental state issue can prove interstate commerce if the agreement is unfulfilled in those circumstances. However, in this case, the object of the conspiracy was completed. The items were moved in interstate commerce, and that's how the government chose to prove the case. If this had just been an agreement and the government had indicted Mr. Scozan and his cohort based on the fact that they intended to receive the cigarettes, they had taken some overt act, but the cigarettes had never come into their possession, the conspiracy had never been completed, well, then the government might be in a position where they could rely on that theory.
But why does it make any difference who drove this truck with the cigarettes? If it had been a normal shipment from Virginia to Illinois and the government had contacted Philip Morris and they had said, oh, you know, one of our trucks is showing up in the Chicago area next Tuesday, and the government took it then, that would be fine in your view. If the government had called up Philip Morris and had said, would you mind driving a truck of cigarettes for us from Virginia or North Carolina to Illinois, and they said fine, that would be enough, I take it, in your view. So why does the simple fact that instead of Philip Morris driving the truck for the government, that they signed the bill of lading over to the government at the Virginia end matter. Anybody who wants to steal a shipment of hard-packed Marlboros in Illinois knows that these Marlboros aren't from Illinois.
I disagree, Your Honor. That is, there is always the possibility that somebody is stealing or taking action to accept a load of stolen cigarettes, that those cigarettes could come from a distributor in Illinois. That is, somebody could break into a warehouse in Illinois, steal cigarettes from that warehouse, and then conduct a sting operation with those cigarettes.
But the cigarettes would have moved in interstate commerce.
But then we
and
go
it
to...
it doesn't matter about knowledge, you agreed a few minutes ago.
I disagree completely with that, Your Honor. The goods have to be part of an interstate shipment to invoke interstate commerce jurisdiction. And that means they have to be en route from the shipper to the consignee. Once the consignee, and this goes to my come to rest issue, once they reach the consignee, they lose all their character as an interstate shipment. Interstate commerce is not implicated. The fact that at one point in time, these cigarettes may have been shipped in interstate commerce is irrelevant if they've come to rest, if they're with a distributor, or if they're stolen from a local warehouse. So those, they're distinct theories, and under the government's theory in this case, it was an interstate shipment. That's what they were trying to prove at trial.
Right,
so that means by your assertion then, if this shipment, which everyone agrees did travel, it had you seem to say it already reached its destination.
Absolutely.
It was no longer moving in interstate commerce.
Correct.
And in order for the charge that the government levied, it had to be intercepted while moving in interstate commerce?
That's what the cases are alleged.
Is that how the jury was instructed?
That's how the jury was instructed. Well, that's one of my the issue I just argued, is there was no instruction on interstate commerce. The jury was completely uninformed as to what the government had to prove on interstate commerce, whether you go with the belief theory or mental state theory, or whether you go with the actual shipment theory. The jury was left in the dark. Nobody told them, well, what do you have to prove? Is it an element of the offense? How do you prove it?
Well, I didn't look at the record as Judge Wood did, but is part of the record where they did say, well, it only requires the knowledge of one conspirator to think it's an interstate commerce, or did they go on this, had to be moving in interstate and, in effect, be intercepted? Because you bring this up pretty heavily in your reply brief.
Yeah.
And they had a chance to answer that, I guess.
Unequivocally, the government chose one theory of prosecution as the interstate commerce in this case. If you look at the government's arguments that I cited in my reply brief, they say belief and intention as to interstate commerce is totally irrelevant. Don't consider that. Consider only the fact that we have shown that these cigarettes were shipped from Virginia to Chicago. Look at the bill of lading. It proves it. So that's how the jury was told, and not instructed, but that's how the government presented the case and argued the case, that it had to be an interstate shipment.
Now, I have to comment that I think your argument on the second part of your case is somewhat inconsistent with the notion that these cigarettes indeed ever came to rest, because your argument there is the reason that nobody had to worry about stamps from Illinois or anything is that they were really on their way to Canada or Poland or some other distant destination, and the cigarettes, far from not being in the flow of interstate commerce anymore, were very much still in that process.
No, well, the arguments are distinct, and I would suggest
I know
not related.
Statutes are different, but just the underlying facts of the one theory don't seem to me consistent. The jury may well have thought these goods were definitely still in transit at the time this transaction was taking place to move them on to the next link in the chain.
Well, the jury could have thought anything, Your Honor, because they were never instructed on the issue. But as far as the Contraband Tax Act, the issue there was whether or not, you know, Mr. Skozin was a distributor under Illinois law, et cetera. It was our position that the cigarettes, once he took possession of them, were going to be transshipped to either Canada or wherever outside the country. Therefore, the Cigarette Tax Act didn't apply.
But that he's not a distributor, and so all these provisions of the Illinois law that apply to distributors don't apply to him, in your view. The federal law makes it a crime for anybody knowingly to possess contraband cigarettes, and contraband cigarettes are those with no evidence of payment. There was no evidence of payment on these cigarettes, and he possessed them.
I agree. He was not a distributor.
End of discussion. And, well, he was possessing contraband cigarettes. He doesn't have to be the one who failed to put the stamp on.
I would suggest that's not the end of the discussion. It's the beginning, because he was charged under the predicate Illinois statute with being a distributor. I said, well, Judge, he's not a distributor. He just intended to transship the cigarettes through Illinois.
But the statute says any person other than a licensed distributor who sells, offers for sale, or has in his possession with intent to sell or offer to sell more than 100 original packages that aren't stamped is guilty of a Class 4 felony. Doesn't that describe him to a T?
But are you talking about the presumption now of?
I'm talking about 35 ILCS 130/24A.
I think that's the, if I'm not mistaken.
Is it a crime to possess more than 100 packages of unstamped cigarettes?
Correct. But that's a totally different statute, not cited as a predicate Illinois statute in the indictment, and deals with circumstances that don't fit this case, that is, with distributors who possess cigarettes in a non-stamp manner.
Well, it says anyone other than a distributor, so it actually deals with non-distributors.
Okay, I think. This particular statute, because Mr. Skousen was charged as a distributor, there are certain exceptions to if distributors are holding cigarettes for transshipment out of the state, then there is no tax.
But they need a permit, which he didn't have.
Well, exactly, but there's
so
a...
So he still is in violation of
well,
the law.
Well, I would concede there may have been a predicate Illinois violation that the government could have charged him with and proven at trial. However, again, this is a matter of election and strategy at trial. They said, we're going to charge him with being a distributor in possession of unstamped cigarette taxes. They could have chosen to charge him with transporting cigarettes without the proper permit. That's a totally different statute. And if you look at the other cases, there are not many, but normally how a case like this is charged is they simply say the defendant violated the CCTA by violating applicable state law. I think that's what the Boggs case, that's the way their indictment was framed. But when the government specifies a particular statute and limits their indictment to that particular statute, that's what they have to prove. I was never on notice that he was going to be charged as somebody transporting cigarettes in violation of Illinois. If I'd seen an indictment like that, I would have responded to it. Unless there's any... I did have one comment on the value aspect of the case. You know, the government contended there was 480,000 packs. I contended that the value should be determined by the actual amount of the cigarettes. And the issue is here that the amount or the intended amount was never clarified. That is, Skousen was saying to the agent, I don't believe you have 480 packs because the truck isn't big enough for that. The agent's saying, well, we do have 480. So Skousen says to him, well, we'll just count them when you show up. And so the value was going to be determined, and the intent of the parties and the defendant was to have value determined by the number of actual cigarettes in the truck. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Ms. Peckman?
May it please the court. I would like to first address the defendant's argument about the interstate commerce element and what he characterizes as a change of theory. His argument, at its most basic, is that the district court should have granted his Rule 29 motion for judgment of acquittal because there was insufficient evidence to support the interstate commerce element. But this argument is based on a false legal premise, and that is that it was legally necessary for the government to prove an actual effect on commerce.
And so how do you respond to this excerpt in the transcript? I don't know if it was you or somebody else for the government, where you said, and the defendant didn't, talking about moving across state lines, and the defendant didn't have to know anything about it, and neither did any of his co-conspirators. They didn't have to know about it, have anything to do with it, didn't have to cause it, didn't have to wish it, didn't have to intend it. And it sounds to me like that's a pretty strong statement by the government that his belief about whether this shipment had moved in interstate commerce is absolutely beside the point. That's what you were telling the jury. So how now is it fair for you to ask us to decide the case on that basis?
Your Honor, there's no question that the trial attorneys did not advance the best argument available to them.
They refuted it.
Yes.
They said, we are not making this argument.
They did mention it briefly in passing in the opening closing argument. However, there is no question that they made what can be considered the wrong argument. But the jury was properly instructed on the elements of a conspiracy and on the elements of the statute.
Well, aren't we stuck, though, at this stage of the game with the task of deciding whether, when it's the government itself that has made sure that these cigarettes really did move in interstate commerce by getting the bill of lading signed over to them in Virginia and actually having their own person drive the truck from Virginia to Illinois, is that going to do? Is the federal government going to be able to prosecute any number of goods stolen from interstate commerce cases just by hiring lots of customs officials or other law enforcement personnel and satisfying the state line requirement that way? I mean, that's a little troubling.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's troubling when the government itself makes sure that you have a shipment that can be stolen from interstate commerce. It's against the law to steal things in every state that I know of. So why do we need federal law in this area? We only get federal law if it's a shipment stolen from interstate commerce.
Your Honor, I think that this is a case that involves commerce. We're looking at a truckload of fresh, hard-box Marlboro cigarettes. And the idea that it would not travel in interstate commerce is somewhat ludicrous.
So what if it had been a truckload of produce that had in fact been driven from Virginia to Illinois by government officials, but it was the same kind of produce grown all over the state of Illinois?
I think that would be a different situation. But here we have a truckload of cigarettes. And there is no question that cigarette tobacco is not grown in Illinois.
What if it had come to rest, as Mr. Meyer argues? What if it had been sitting there in a warehouse in Springfield for 6 months waiting to be distributed?
That is not this case.
Well, I know, but what if it were? You know, your idea is that the fact that it moved in interstate commerce because the government drove it, or at least that was the trial theory, and I'm suggesting if we have to stick to the trial theory, can you win?
I think if you have to stick to the trial theory, then you have to look at the defendant's argument, which is it's manufactured jurisdiction. And
mm-hmm.
The manufactured jurisdiction doctrine is disfavored by the Seventh Circuit. The cases that support manufactured jurisdiction are not cases like this. It's the would be the Second Circuit case in Archer where it was a telephone call, not a big, huge truckload of fresh Marlboro cigarettes. Another case that the defendant cites is the Brantley case out of the Fourth Circuit, and that is, if you look at it compared to this case, in that case, the Fourth Circuit rejected the substantive conviction for the violation of the Hobbs Act, but affirmed the conspiracy conviction, noting that it was the defendant's belief and their intent or their understanding that there would be an effect on interstate commerce had everything been as they believed it to be, that could be sustained. And again, this is a situation where the evidence was present in the record. The indictment, in fact, charges North Carolina. The jury was properly instructed on the conspiracy element, that it was an agreement. The government did not advance the best argument, but arguments are not evidence. And that's why we look to the judge to instruct on the law, and the jury was properly instructed on the law here.
On the theory that you argued, or they argued, what was the destination of these cigarettes?
the destination of the cigarette?
Yeah, if they're
ultimately
traveling, yeah, well, they're traveling in interstate commerce from wherever they came from, Virginia, to where?
The defendant and his co-conspirators intended to ship these cigarettes to Canada and possibly onto Poland. That's what was demonstrated at trial.
Was there a bill of lading or anything that on these particular cigarettes?
The bill of lading in this case was presented by, or was the Philip Morris witness who came to testify. The bill of lading reflected that the cigarettes had been given to the customs agency. But this is the determination of whether it's an interstate commerce is really a practical determination. And there's no question that these cigarettes were not being sent to the Customs Service to stay with the Customs Service. They were to go to the defendant, who then believed he was going to ship them out of the country.
Well, can he intercept, if he's the destination, if that's correct, can he intercept something before it reaches the destination, if he's the destination?
I'm sorry, if the defendant is the destination?
Yeah. I don't know what your theory was, but if I'm trying to figure out if under the argument of these moving in interstate commerce, and that they supposedly intercepted. Now, if it's going on to Canada, okay, that's maybe there's some destination you can extend it beyond that, and they intercepted it, as opposed to going to what's his name, Skotzen?
Skotzen,
yeah, as opposed to going to him.
Well, Skotzen and his co-conspirators planned to transport these cigarettes out of the country to Canada. They, in fact, were going to take the actual trailer of cigarettes, and it was simply going to be unhitched from the customs, I guess it's called a tractor, and rehitched to their tractor so they could drive on.
So it's still moving interstate commerce even though it's stolen?
I don't believe that it stopped with the defendant. I think that the idea was that he was going to ship the cigarettes out of the country.
Yeah, after he sold them.
Am I answering your question?
Well, I guess so. If that's part of the deal, it continues in interstate commerce after it's stolen.
It was going to continue in interstate commerce after it was stolen. That's the second object of the conspiracy charge. Again, I would just point out this idea that the government is injecting a new theory here. This theory was present through the jury instructions and through the evidence that the government presented.
Which instruction in particular are you relying on?
Your Honor, there's the general conspiracy instruction, which instructs, of course, on the definition of a conspiracy, that it's an agreement between two or more persons to accomplish an unlawful purpose, and goes through the elements of a conspiracy. Additionally, the jury was instructed on the elements of the objects of the conspiracy, and they were provided the statutory language.
So that's about it in terms of interstate commerce. They didn't get the word interstate commerce.
Your Honor, they were also instructed that the term interstate commerce means movement across state lines. There was
so they have to have been relying on the testimony that was presented to them at trial from the government's witnesses that these cigarettes started out in Virginia and wound up in Illinois.
Yeah.
What else did they have before them that would have allowed them to answer that question?
Your Honor, they also had the testimony of the undercover agent and tapes of the defendant talking with the undercover agent about cigarettes that were to be coming from Carolina, up from Carolina, through Indianapolis, to a truck stop in Indiana.
This is the one that didn't happen, but this is where he's saying, I want hard-pack Marlboros?
He's saying that, in both transactions, if I remember correctly. And he's trying to get financing for both transactions from the same source, and he's going to sources and saying, I can get cigarettes, this quantity of cigarettes, from what he referred to as the Spanish people or the hillbillies, which were the two different sets of agents that he was negotiating with. But that evidence was before the jury, the defendant's understanding that his own words, that he understood the cigarettes were coming from Carolina, that they were going to come through Indianapolis and be dropped off at a truck stop in Indiana.
So what would give us any confidence that the jury had any idea that it was simply his understanding that was enough and not the physical fact that these cigarettes did in fact move?
Because what the lawyers say about the law is not the law, and that is how they
instructed. I know that, but if the jury is told, if you could tell me, here's the instruction that the district court gave that made sure the jury understood, is it's the district court that gives the law to the jury. They don't make it up in their own minds either.
Your Honor, I think I would look at the conspiracy instruction, which does instruct that a conspiracy is an agreement to do these things, and the government must prove that the conspiracy that was charged existed. And then if you turn to the elements instruction, it says that he is charged with the following offenses or conspiring to commit the following offenses against the United States. When you bring these two instructions together, it's clear that the government needed to prove an agreement to do the elements of the substantive offense, and only an agreement. I would also just like to note that this idea of conspiracy law was recognized below, although not in this interstate commerce context, but in the defendant's closing argument when the defendant was discussing whether or not the government would need to prove that the cigarettes were in fact stolen, and recognized that with a conspiracy, the government doesn't have to prove that the cigarettes were stolen, but only that the defendant believed that they were stolen. So this is a situation where the jury was properly instructed, the evidence was there for them to find this, and we trust that the jury followed their instructions, notwithstanding the government's bad argument. Just to touch briefly on the Contraband Cigarette Trafficking Act point, federal law is directed at any person who knowingly possesses cigarettes upon which applicable state taxes have not been paid. And this is not about a distributor and whether or not Mr. Scoven was a distributor.
But I think Mr. Meyer's point is that you mentioned, as I recall, two different sections of the Illinois statutes in the indictment, and once again, don't seem to be really sticking to that at this stage of the game.
The indictment defines contraband cigarettes. All that the indictment needs to do is charge every essential element and doesn't need to negate every applicable statutory exception. But the indictment does refer to these two Illinois statutes to talk about the duty of a distributor to affix taxes.
Right.
But that in no way changes the federal crime, which makes it a crime for any person to possess cigarettes upon which the requisite state taxes had not been paid.
Why wouldn't the defendant be lulled into thinking that those state statutes are the way in which he's allegedly violated the federal statute?
Because the language of the federal statute makes clear that it's any person who knowingly possesses these cigarettes. And so it didn't matter if the defendant was a distributor or got them from a distributor who failed to affix the tax stamp. In other words, this is just a reference, a superfluous reference to the Illinois statutes to define contraband cigarettes. But it's the federal statute that we look at for the charged conduct. Finally, I believe the defendant mentioned that the amount of loss argument, which is that the defendant planned to count the cigarettes. The fact of the matter is the defendant negotiated to purchase 480,000 packs of cigarettes with a value of $421,920. That he might have discovered a shortage if he'd gone through with counting them is really not relevant. It's the intended loss that counts. It wouldn't have mattered if the trailer were empty. This is what he contemplated purchasing. And the court's determination of the loss amount on that point is not clearly erroneous. If the court has no further questions, I'll conclude.
All right. Thank you, Speaker.
Thank you. The government respectfully requests that you affirm the convictions and sentence.
Mr. Meyer.
First of all, I think there was a question to the government about, well, what if the circumstance was that, as far as the come to rest argument, the final destination, what if these cigarettes had sat in a warehouse in Springfield for 6 months? The government said, well, that didn't happen. However, the facts are they sat in a warehouse in Chicago for 3 months, furthering my position as far as the final destination. Another point on the final destination, and that is the issue about the bill of lading. The bill of lading listed the consignor, that is the shipper, as Philip Morris. The consignee was the customs, United States Customs and ATF in Chicago. And there is no question in this case that the cigarettes were delivered to customs pursuant to this bill of lading, And pursuant to all the case law, to which the government had cited no contrary authority, that ended conclusively the shipment and means they had reached their final destination. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Meyer, thanks to all counsel. Mr. Meyer, a special thanks to you from the court for accepting this appointment and the way we're representing Mr. Scotia.
Thank you.